This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
To work with us on your podcast, go to soundrebel.co.uk. Over the Influence is no longer just a podcast. Our online community is buzzing with people like you.
I'm Allie and I live in Southern California. I'm a huge fan of OTI. Their joyful outlook on sobriety is what finally inspired me to quit drinking. I've been a member since day one and I'm rapidly approaching 365 days alcohol-free, which is unreal. I love that Ben and Shaz are not just the podcast hosts. They also openly engage with members during the multiple weekly Zoom meetings and interact on the community member forum. You will not find a more supportive group of people. There's nothing like this in the United States. I'm beyond grateful to be a part of the Sober Rebellion.
So if you want to join us, go to overtheinfluence.co.uk.
Welcome to Over the Influence, safe to say. And I'm going to say it, even though Ben will probably frown. We are possibly, if not the best, alcohol-free podcast in all of the actual land. We sing very loudly about sobriety. We share all the amazing positives about removing alcohol from your life. We also, of course, talk about the rubbish bits as well, because it's not without its difficult days. However, we will be very vocal about the absolute joys of sobriety, probably until the end of actual time itself. If you are just tuning in for the very first time, my name is Sharon Hartley, based in Lancashire in the northwest of England. For about 4 years, 2 months now, alcohol-free. Was only going to take a quick break back in the summer of 2018 and thought I'd fully get back on it after my birthday in time for, can't remember, December. But something crack has happened. I fell in love with sobriety and I absolutely adore alcohol-free life. It's a complete game changer. Who knew? And to answer a question that I get asked all the time, very quickly, how much did you drink? How bad did it get? I drank daily and I drank too much, too fast, too often. Dead excited to get into today's chat with our very special guest today. Before we introduce you to him, Ben, how are you doing? How's new daddy Ben?
Yes, I'm all right, thank you, Sharon. Leo is 6 weeks and 2 days old now, and I think I'm going to be saying this at the start of every podcast for a very long time. I'm still tired. I was doing the 3 o'clock in the morning feed last night, so I'm doing this recording. Am I here? Who am I? What is my name? Is this a dream? But no, I am Ben. I am here. I'm 34. I live in Liverpool. I am fiancé to Jem, dad to Leo, stepdad, soon to be stepdad to Alfie and Millie, and I am over 2 years alcohol free and absolutely love alcohol free life. For me, it's changed everything. It's just the key that's opened many doors for me. It's the thing I needed to get right for lots of other great things to happen. I love this podcast, and I love it in particular when we get a guest on that actually, Ryan, it really means something to me today to have you on the podcast. And it's, I don't want to fanboy too much, but can I give it away, Shaz? Ryan is the founding drummer of Maroon 5. And I just want to, I suppose, make a distinction, because Maroon 5, you've got the kind of jingly jangly moves like Jagger Maroon 5. But you've also got My Maroon 5, and My Maroon 5 is Songs About Jane Maroon 5. Songs About Jane is still in my top five albums of all time. I was about 14 when Songs About Jane came out, and I took so much from it, and I listened to it all summer, back to back, round and round on CD. Ryan, it's absolutely great to meet you. Thank you so much for coming on Over the Influence. And Shaz, I've just stole your bit. I'm sorry.
Thank you very much for having me. That was quite an intro.
Ryan, he said before we started recording that he wasn't going to fanboy. Well, that didn't last long, did it at all? Ryan Dusick, as Ben said there, founding drummer of Maroon 5. Book out today, Harder to Breathe. We've got so much to talk about. As Ben said, welcome to Over the Influence. It's fantastic to have you here. Can we just talk for a second about your background on this Zoom call? Look at it. Describe it. I've never seen as many drums. I mean, you are a drummer. Yes.
It's getting a little crowded in here, isn't it? This is my studio at my house. This is something that took me years to conceptualize and then finally build. And then I changed careers and became a therapist. So I've got this sort of man cave filled with drums and guitars and amps and all kinds of fun stuff. And it's just fun. And this is where I kind of like, you know, just feel myself and feel creative. This is where I wrote my book too.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, let's start with that. We've got a lot to talk about, Ryan. Let's start with the book. It's out today. It's called Harder to Breathe. And it's described as a roller coaster memoir about how making it to the top sent you to the bottom and how you let go of the past and embraced a new future one breath at a time. A lot to unpick there. We'll let you start, Ryan.
Yeah, well, this book is really the culmination of a long journey for me, which started long before I was in Maroon 5. But the sort of meat and potatoes of the story, the center of the book is really about those years, starting the band in high school, working for a decade together from my parents' garage all the way up to, you know, arenas all over the world. And it's, you know, it's a, I think, a fun and inspiring journey, just that part, but really the larger arc of it is about my mental health journey and what I went through, breaking down on tour, eventually losing that career as the drummer in Maroon 5, and going into a decade of depression, alcoholism, pretty serious anxiety disorder, and eventually finding recovery. And I've been sober for 6.5 years now. And my new life, my new path has been really just inspiring. I went back to school to become a therapist. And then I wrote this book while I was in grad school. And it's, like I said, it's kind of the culmination of that journey where it's taking everything that was and everything that was challenging. And now it's become something that is hopefully going to help some people if they can relate to, you know, my story and find some hope in my recovery.
I mean, where do we start, Ryan? You're in this band and it's everyone's dream, isn't it? You're in I don't know if you were, but I imagine you were in a garage, you know, getting together, you're teenagers and the dream is stadiums, isn't it? Did you ever imagine it would happen? Because it was almost, and I don't know if this is because we're in the UK, one day everyone knew who Maroon 5 were because songs about Jane had come out and we'd not heard of you before. Did it feel that quick to you guys?
Absolutely not. No.
Never does.
It was an overnight success that took a decade, you know.
Yeah.
When we started the band, absolutely, we did not have any, you know, mental image of playing arenas or stadiums. We were really just, four grungy kids in a garage in 1994 when we started the band. I was 16 years old and we were huge Pearl Jam fans, Soundgarden, Nirvana. Like, it was the 90s. It was grunge rock. And we were all wearing flannel and corduroys and had greasy hair. And, it was just we had dreams, but it was really just fun. It was just four close friends having fun. And, but it happened pretty quick in terms of it getting more serious. I think 1995, we got our first independent record deal, which led to our first major record deal in 1996. And we put out an album in 1997 thinking that was the moment we're going to be an overnight success and, all that, but it flopped completely. And we got dropped from our label. And then it took another 5 years after that of sort of reconvening, try to figure out, are we going to keep going? Are we going to be a band? And if so, what kind of band at this point? And we had to kind of start over from base one and redefine what kind of band we were going to be. And in that time, we figured out our new sound. We became Maroon 5 and we made Songs About Jane. And then we were on the road for 2 years promoting Songs About Jane in the States before it came out internationally and before it blew up on a big scale. So it really was a full decade and a few years even on that album until it all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, until it there was the tipping point, you know, where it all of a sudden became massive.
And what part did alcohol play in the story at this point? Because, you know, band on tour, it's a cliche, but sex and drugs and rock and roll and alcohol. You know, what part did alcohol play? Were you an inverted commas normal drinker at this point?
Yeah, I mean, looking back, it wasn't to the level that I would say was problematic when I was performing. I can recognize ways in which my relationship with alcohol was already alcoholic. It, just thinking about the psychology of it and the sort of obsessive thoughts about it. I started drinking. I was actually kind of late to the game. You know, most of my friends and stuff started drinking and smoking pot when they were teenagers. I was pretty straight edge. Like, I wasn't into that until my 20s. I tried to kind of loosen up and have a little fun in college and stuff. And drinking was really just something to facilitate fun with my friends. And it didn't really have any negative effects at that point in my life. When we went on the road for Songs About Jane in 2002, we knew we were going to be on the road for a long time. We were in it for the long haul. And my attitude was, well, I got to try to enjoy this. You know, I'm kind of a homebody by nature. It's not a lifestyle that really suited me very naturally. The circus life, really. So I wanted to just kind of like embrace every moment and try to just go out on the road and have fun. And it worked for a while. I mean, we weren't drinking every night. We weren't, you know, I don't remember performing wasted or hungover very often. You know, I mean, maybe a buzz every now and then or a little, you know, a little hungover, but it was not a nightly thing. It was mostly like if we had a night off, then we'd kind of party and have fun just to, you know, blow off some steam. But the problem became when things became more intense and my body started breaking down and my mind and my spirit was started breaking down. And then playing and performing became a problem. I was having physical issues playing the drums. And when I had to start taking breaks from performing and we had other drummers coming in to fill in for me, and I found myself sort of sitting around watching the band from afar and feeling really sorry for myself, you know, just feeling really beat down and my self-esteem was getting lower and lower. And that's when the relationship with the alcohol shifted for me. It became self-medication at that point, you know, trying to escape the negative feelings, trying to numb the pain, physical and emotional pain. And then it, you know, my relationship with alcohol became definitely alcoholic at that point. And it was that way for a decade. When I left the band officially in 2006, it was like everything that was defining of me was gone. You know, my identity had been sort of stripped of me, and the band was still out there, obviously having a lot of success. And I was back home just trying to figure out what I was going to do with the rest of my life. So alcohol became my friend at that point. It became a way to cope. It was a coping mechanism. And I really didn't have any other skills at that point to cope. And so that was the beginning of that chapter of my life where I was dealing with, you know, real alcoholism.
Ryan, what impacts did the alcohol and the effects it have on you have on your relationships within the band? How did that sort of pan out?
Well, you know, like I said, when I was performing, it wasn't really a big factor. But when I was not performing and I was still trying to be around the band, I would go out on stretches with them on tour because I wanted to be connected to what was going on, even though I wasn't playing. And I would sing my backup vocals from the side of the stage. And we were doing a lot of stuff that wasn't just performing. You know, we were doing appearances and we were going on TV shows and we were doing photo shoots. And so I was involved with stuff that was going on at that point around 2005, 2006. But my relationship with the band definitely started to get affected by where I was at because we weren't really communicating well. You know, we were guys in our 20s, they knew that I was struggling, but it wasn't something that was comfortable to talk about. It wasn't something I was comfortable talking about. So I would just kind of try to put on this this mask, you know, this alter ego, which was I'm here with the guys having fun, partying like a rock star. And so I would kind of just show up and get wasted and pretend like it was all a lot of fun. And then I would come down to earth and be really depressed. They didn't see that part, though. They just saw me kind of acting crazy. And so I think they were growing a little resentful of the fact that I was out there not performing, coming out for stretches and going home. And from their perspective, and I can understand because I was wearing this mask, from their perspective, I was just kind of enjoying the fruits of our success without having to do the work, you know, just sort of showing up and having a party while they were the ones that were going on stage and having to sing and perform. So I understandably they made some comments to me a few times, you know, like it must be nice to just like come and go as you please and just like come out on the road and party. But I didn't understand that at that time, you know, because it was like, can they not tell that this is misery for me?
Yeah. Did you want them to notice? Right. Did you almost want them to go, right, we can see there's a massive problem. And why didn't you talk about it, if you don't mind me asking? Because we talked to a lot of people on the podcast, and in a lot of cases, men in particular, no matter what their age. There was just a guy on last week. He wasn't a rock star, just a normal fella from Lancashire. But again, he just wasn't able to talk about it until the problem got so bad. Did you want to be seen? Did you want people to know there was an issue, but with almost without having to vocalize that yourself?
Yes and no. It was kind of a... there was a duality to the experience of, yeah, desperately wanting people to care for me, but also just, it was so painful and so such an uncomfortable position to be in that I just wanted to pretend like it wasn't happening. We would do like meet and greets, you know, with our fan club and stuff like that. And people would ask me, what's going on? Like, why aren't you performing? And I would just joke and make up stories. You know, I'd be like, oh, I got in a boating accident. Or I was attacked by a bear, you know, and I was trying to make the other guys laugh, you know, and just because it was like when you have feelings that are so immense and like my, you know, sense of self was really suffering. I couldn't even really verbalize what it was that I was feeling. And it was so uncomfortable to sit in it at all. And yes, I think there was also that element, you know, as a young man, you have pride. You know, you don't want to be vulnerable, you know, and there's just, I guess that's just the way that we're socialized, you know, especially with our mates, as you say, you know, you just, you go about your business and you pretend like you're tough and you're just like, oh yeah, whatever, it's fine. And it wasn't fine. And I just couldn't even really admit that to myself, let alone to anyone else. But yes, at the same time, of course, I wanted people to be there for me.
Moving on to the next part of the story then. So you left the band and went back home. What happened next?
Well, you know, I'd been trying to come back from my physical injuries for like a year at that point, and it wasn't happening, and the band had to move on. In some ways, when I was out of the band officially, in that moment, it was a little bit of a relief, you know, because I just felt like I'd been pushing so hard and feeling so defeated, and now I could try to just turn around and get on with my life. So there was a moment of relief, and then there was just the sinking feeling of everything that I've been working for 12 years, everything that was defining of me at that point in my life. I mean, just imagine, you know, age 16 to 28, you know, from a kid living with his parents to a millionaire living in a house in the Hollywood Hills, you know, just that moment in life when you're making something of yourself as a young man, my entire identity was wrapped up in being in that band. And also my entire social life, you know, all of my best friends were either in the band or were friends with the bands. And I was really uncomfortable around everyone who had been close to me. So, you know, when that all just kind of hit me, I think when I look back on it now as sort of dealing with the stages of grief, there was this denial at first, you know, this isn't happening. It's not a problem, whatever, nothing to look at. And there were all the stages, the bargaining, the depression. When I hit that depression, it was like, whew, I went really low and I just completely pulled away from everyone and everything and was isolating. The first year or two that I was out of the band was dark. I mean, it was like heavy drinking, just trying to do anything to distract myself. And I did have a few friends pull me aside and tell me, like, we're concerned about you. You really seem like you're struggling and you're drowning. And at that point, I told myself, I don't want to be that guy. I don't want people to be concerned about me. I just need to, it's been enough time now. It's time for me to just get on with my life. And so as most alcoholics do, I'm sure you're familiar with this phase of the drinking cycle. I got my shit together, right? Where I had this feeling, now I've got it under control. All I have to do is, you know, drink responsibly and moderately, you know, drink like a gentleman.
What did that look like for you, Ryan, to interrupt me there? What was drinking like a gentleman? What was doing it moderately? I can't say the word myself, moderately. and as you did there, you did the air quotes, you got your shit together. What was that supposed to look like?
Well, really, it was more just putting on a better show for everyone, getting better at hiding it. Really, that's what it looked like, right? I started taking breaks, you know, sobering myself up and convincing myself that it wasn't a problem because I could take breaks and I could sober myself up. And I would, I lost a little bit of weight. You know, I started exercising more again. I started showing up to, you know, events, family events and things, you know, fresh faced and looking my best and, you know, have with a smile on my face and just have a couple drinks and just, but then I'd go home, you know, and go back to drinking when people weren't looking, you know? And so in some ways, I was doing a little bit better. It looked a little rosier on the outside. It didn't look like I was drowning, but really I was just in this push and pull, with the demon, right? Just pretending and believing the illusion of control, right? That's a chapter in my book, The Illusion of Control. But that went on for years, you know, convincing myself that there's a perfect formula to be able to do this and, you know, just have fun drinking, but not to the point where it's a problem. And then every time it ending up back in that place where I'm feeling shameful, I'm feeling sick and, you know, and then just having to start the cycle again. Oh, I'm going to get my shit together now. That worked, you know, off and on, and then until it didn't work, right?
I'm really interested to, you said, you know, you're a 20-something bloke living in a mansion in the Hollywood Hills. You know, you've gone from the garage to being a millionaire. Did that kind of, the fact that you were, you know, you didn't have any financial worries, did that kind of play into the addiction? And what I mean by that is, you haven't got to get up and go anywhere every day. You haven't got to get up and go to work. You haven't got to pay the bills. The bills are sorted. Do you think that having that kind of that financial base, shall we say, gave you, was it more difficult to find direction because of that?
Yeah, that was definitely a contributing factor because I didn't have any of the sort of consequences that would come from, you know, staying up all night drinking and sleeping until the afternoon, like, you know, not showing up for work or showing up to work hungover or, you know, I had the time and the resources to protect my addiction, you know? So it was a very insidious and, sort of slippery slope where, I could easily rationalize the fact that I was living such an unmanageable lifestyle because I didn't have the responsibilities that necessitated me, you know, being more responsible. And to be honest, that was really a mind fuck for me too, because here I was in the most blessed situation that I think most people could dream of, minus the losing of the career, but having the resources, having the money, having the lifestyle of leisure that most people would dream of. And yet I'm in misery inside and self-medicating and feeling sorry for myself and feeling like I don't deserve it. You know, I was the drummer in Maroon 5 who can't play the drums. It's like, why do I deserve, you know, this house and this car and the money I have in the bank? So again, and then, you know, wanting to feel grateful, wanting to feel like, wow, I am so blessed. I am so incredibly, you know, grateful for the success that I've had and for the life I get to live, and then being mad at myself for not being able to really feel it because of all that. So it really was a complicated thing. I didn't want to complain. You know, I didn't feel like anyone would understand if I complained. It's like, who wants to hear, you know, a rich guy complaining about how miserable his life is? It would be obnoxious. So, but I was miserable, and the, you know, all of the trappings of success didn't make it any better. You know, if you have resources, it can facilitate good times if you're a happy person, but it's not going to make you happy if you're not, you know? And so chasing that over and over again, looking for just any kind of instantaneous way to step out of that pain and into something enjoyable, it's just a Band-Aid. right? It doesn't fix what's broken inside of you. And so it was this vicious cycle that I went through, and where the shame comes from, and where the, you know, it's like, oh, I'm enjoying this. It's like, no, I'm really not enjoying this. And then I feel shameful. And then I need to medicate that. And you just keep going back through that vicious cycle.
It just shows you as well, though, what you've just shared with us there. It doesn't matter the money. It doesn't matter the success. It doesn't matter who you are and pretty much whatever it is you do. If alcohol gets you, it gets you, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. And it's insidious. I mean, I think we have sort of checks and balances to our life. And if those aren't in place, things can get out of control pretty quick.
We're just going to take a really quick break from this ace chat with Ryan. I mean, I'm enjoying it, and it's usually me that fangirls my way through. Ben, you're beside yourself today.
Adam Levine's going to look at his Spotify stats and go, songs about Jane's got a lot of plays recently. Let's say hello, Chaz, today. I don't want to alienate any of our listeners in the UK, but I feel because we've got Ryan calling us from the United States of America, I want to take this opportunity to say, hello, America. Because can you believe it, Sharon? One in four people who listen to Over the Influence are American.
You know,
I've been looking at the stats. I've been checking the analytics.
You do like a figure, don't you? He likes to go behind the scenes of the analytics here at Over the Influence.
I do.
That's incredible.
Well, sorry. I mean, it's 23.5% United States.
Almost
if we're going to get into the detail, but 3.1% in Canada. So, you know, over 25% if you're talking about North America. Which is amazing because we, you know, we're obviously based in the UK and we say things like wanging on. What other things? Big up yourself.
Big up your bad self. I say brilliant quite a lot. I mean, that is obviously a word
I think that translates.
That translates well in America. But the reason I picked that up, I've had emails from listeners in America and they're laughing, but in a brilliant way. Not laughing at us, laughing with us. And what's what really... Well,
okay.
That's what
I'm glad you're taking it that
anyway.
Way.
But they always pick up on the use of my word, ain't it brilliant? Ain't it brilliant? Like you say, we're always wagging on about sobriety. I imagine that some of our Northern English dialect might, I don't know, do they understand us? Well, I certainly hope so. But I tell you what.
There's some people in London, to be fair, who listen to this and go, what is Shazza talking about?
What the frick is that woman on about? I mean, do you need a translator? But I think what does come across is our absolute passion for what we do. It's ace that we've got so many listeners in America. And actually, while we're on that theme, we've got so many people in the community now from the actual US of A.
Yes, we have. We've had some new joiners this week, haven't we, from all over the States, which
all
is
over.
Amazing.
I mean, you know, my geography is appalling. And so when we have a Zoom call going, I always say, oh, Chris is from New York. Are you near him? And they're like, no, we're 3 million miles away. Same country, very different area, Sharon.
Yeah, it's a very big country, 330 million people. I think at some point in this episode, I say 360 million. And I've checked it. It's 330 million.
Okay, fair dues.
You know, I like the detail,
like
Sharon.
A figure.
But there are many, many Americans. Is it Chris, by the way, who's flying over next year? Scarfell Pike.
No, it's not Scarfell Pike. He is flying over. He's planning his trip as we speak, and he's joining us for the actual Ben Nevis weekend. He's coming over. He's coming over to do the UK's highest mountain with a bunch of randoms off the internet from Over the Influence. And it's just
brilliant.
So exciting, Ben. So exciting.
Yeah. But look, if you are in North America and you feel like you want some connection, some community, yes, okay, we're based in the UK, but we've got more and more Americans joining us every single day. And we are starting now. We've got specific American time zone Zooms, haven't we, led by Ali. And also, I'm going to start doing some. As soon as the kind of baby stuff calms down a bit, I want to do some Good Morning America Zooms, mainly because I like the title.
I love that title.
But look, you know, I know that we're in the UK, but that's one of the great things about an online community is that you can join from anywhere in the world. And of course, the forums 24/7, the events are a bit more difficult to get to, but as Chris is showing from New York, not impossible. And of course, as the community grows over there, we're going to hope to start doing more events. And again, coming back to Shaz's point, it might be easier to fly to the UK than it would be from coast to coast, potentially, within the US. But yeah, don't be put off because we're based in the UK and you're in a different country. If you want to join us, of course you can, and you'd be more than welcome, and you can learn more English words.
Absolutely. Cannot wait. Get involved. overtheinfluence.co.uk. Let's get back to Ben fanboying over this chat with Ryan.
Yep, and we'll see y'all soon.
Don't do that.
See y'all soon.
Please.
It's really interesting to talk about the success side of it, and I'm not money obsessed, Ryan, but I think, I don't know if you have this over in the US, but the kind of the stereotypical, if you ask someone to point out an alcoholic in the UK, they'd point at it's a classic park bench. You know, the guy wakes up on a park bench, he's lost everything, he's wearing the same clothes he's had on for the last 5 days, his beard's scraggly, he's got a can of something in his hand. That's the kind of classic picture of an alcoholic. Why do you think that society does that? One of our community members once said to me, Ben, I didn't wake up on a park bench. I woke up in a 10 grand fucking bed, was the exact quote. But why is that not talked about? Why do you think that the park bench image is the one, not the guy sitting on his own in the Hollywood Hills?
Yeah, well, I think that that's the image that people have, and that's certainly true in the States too, you know, just this, an alcoholic is somebody who has completely lost everything. Addiction comes in all shapes and sizes, right? And if you have money, if you have, if you're at the top of the food chain, it just looks a little different in terms of, the liquor might be a little bit more expensive. You know, the drug of choice might be a little bit more, upscale than a street drug. But, you know, the devastation and the toll it can take on your life and your relationships and your sense of meaning in life, your spiritual life, is the same. You know, I mean, if you're blessed to, you know, not lose everything and not end up on the street, then obviously you have some comforts that others don't have. But that doesn't mean it's not going to ruin your life. And I think you don't hear about it as much because you just assume if somebody's doing well in one aspect of their life, if they're still, you know, their career is still okay, or they're still, their family hasn't left them, you know, that they must be all right. It's not to the extent that it's terrible, but you never know what's going on behind the scenes. And I've working in the field that I do now as a therapist, you know, there are people that seem to externally have everything together. And then you peel back the curtain and you see that, you know, their whole lives are really being devastated by this. Their children, their marriages, their ambitions in life, you know, everything is being affected by their addiction and the things that they haven't been able to overcome or work through. And that's true whether you're on a park bench or you're in a $10,000 bed, I think.
Ryan, at what point did you go, okay, I was founding drummer of Maroon 5, you've been at the very, very top, and then things changed. At what point did you go, okay, I'm now going to become a therapist, I'm going to give back, I'm going to help other people? What was the turning point there?
Well, I felt sorry for myself for about a decade, and I had that mask of alcohol until at the end it became just very clear to me that my life was unmanageable and that I was powerless over my addiction. And I really was humbled. You know, I have really sort of been, thankfully, again, very gratefully, not to the point where I was on the street, but spiritually, very definitely at a bottom in spiritually and feeling sick, physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. So in 2016, I was lucky enough to get the help that I needed to have that moment of clarity where I realized that if I kept going the direction that I was going, I was just going to keep getting worse and worse until I died. Right. So walking in the other direction, just one step at a time, I finally had acceptance that that was really the only choice I could make. And I had the support that I needed. I was in a relationship that was supportive of my recovery, my family. I went into rehab. everything was in place that was helpful for me. And all I had to do was just accept it, embrace it, and move forward. And it really was life-changing for me in terms of the awakening that happened when all of a sudden I felt connected to life again. And I think where the transition happened to becoming a therapist, the first seedlings of it was when I was still in rehab and I was getting an education about addiction and recovery and about all the mental health issues that underlie addiction and what drives it. And learning all this stuff and then realizing even like 2 weeks into sobriety, I could be helpful to another human being just because I had two more weeks than somebody who was just coming in. Right. And so I could give them a little bit of encouragement or show them to their room and tell them, you know, acclimate them to the process and explain what I'd learned in 2 weeks. And it was like, that was a light bulb going off moment where I realized here I've been suffering and struggling and feeling sorry for myself for all these months and years. And for the first time in a long time, I feel a sense of purpose and usefulness in the world. And I got a little addicted to that, you know, but it was a good kind of addiction. It was like, I could really use some of this feeling of feeling connected to other people, connected to life, to actually reaching a point in my life where I have something to offer. And then realizing I did have things to offer. I had just forgotten because they were buried underneath all the alcohol. And so as I stepped through the process of recovery, and 6 months in, I was volunteering at a recovery center just because I wanted to, it was good for my sobriety, but I also wanted to, give back at that point and just share something of what I'd learned personally. And I was getting good feedback from people, you know, the people that I was, in groups with and telling my story, they would tell me, oh, you're really good at articulating, you know, the ideas of recovery, and the way that you talk about your story is really hopeful and inspiring to me. You should do this for a living. And I hadn't even thought of it really. I just, you know, but on top of it feeling purposeful, it was also just the first time in a long time that I had some self-confidence again. I was like, oh, there's some talents or something that I have to offer that either was there and I didn't realize and I had forgotten about, or it was new. It was something I'd gained in the process of struggling and overcoming. And so I decided to go back to school and learn more and get a master's degree in clinical psychology.
Wow.
And become a therapist. And then I wrote a book.
And that's that. That's just brilliant. That's really good. The way you were talking there about community and giving back and helping others, it sounds very similar to Over the Influence and how this podcast came about and how our community came about, because I've never wanted to shout from the rooftops louder that there's another way. There's absolutely another way. And, you know, no matter how many times you might run up at this and think, can't do it. You absolutely can. You can with the right help, the right guidance, the right support, the right therapy, whatever it is you need. Once you have nailed it, oh, my God. And what you've just described there, you've gone back to university, you've got your master's, you are a qualified therapist, you've written a book, you've lifted the lid on your world, and it's absolutely glorious, Ryan.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It feels really good. It's an inspiring time in my life. And really it just happened just doing the next indicated action each day, you know, just putting one foot in front of the other and embracing whatever opportunities present themselves.
Ryan, can we talk about the book then? Harder to Breathe. Dan Ow. You can't not hear that riff.
Oh, God, what was that, Ben? What did you just do then?
And then the drums come in. It's great. It's the opener of Songs About Jane.
Just play the air drums, Ryan Stoss.
Yeah, shouldn't do that when there's a drummer in the room, even if it's in the Zoom room. Ryan, tell us about the book.
The book Harder to Breathe is out today in stores, and it's very
Congratulations.
Exciting. Thank you. I dreamt about writing a book when I was a kid. You know, this is another dream of mine, a dream deferred, you know, because the music became the passion. But I fancied myself a writer when I was a kid. I ended up actually my undergrad degree at UCLA was in English. So I studied literature and wrote a lot of essays and stuff then. And when I left the band and I was going through everything I was going through, I thought about for the first time writing a book. I knew I had some stories to tell. I just didn't know what the purpose would be, really. And so it never really came to fruition at that point. But then I was in recovery and I was in grad school and I was doing all this self-reflection that was necessary to become a therapist. And I was, you know, doing the work of recovery, both in my personal therapy and in the 12 steps. And then this book just started like coming out of me. Like I woke up one morning and I just had to sit down at my computer and start writing, because I think the turning point was I realized there's a happy ending to this book now. And there's a purpose for it. You know, I've been telling my story in meetings. I've been personally inspired and in a way that I didn't think was possible just a few years earlier. And maybe if I write a book in a really honest and vulnerable way and really just talk about my journey and the depths that I got to in my suffering and where I'm at now in my recovery, it just might help someone out there and inspire them in their own recovery. And so I was like a man on a mission, you know. It was just the next thing that was like, okay, I got to do this. And then I realized like, wow, I used to love writing and I'm pretty good at it. And so I just poured myself into it. And I started during when the pandemic started. It was in quarantine in 2020. I had a little more time. My classes were online and I just started writing. And then here we are a couple years later and it's coming out, Harder to Breathe.
I love that. And we always talk about that, Shaz, don't we, within the community and the Zoom calls and stuff about, you know, you give up alcohol and suddenly that you reconnect with stuff. You go, I used to bloody love doing this. I can't.
Honestly.
When did that, it's when your drinking career starts, isn't it? These things, and it doesn't have to be, you know, some people give up booze and run marathons and climb mountains. It doesn't have to be, does it? Some people rediscover their love for drawing and they get the pad out again and they give it, you know, it's just... Isn't it amazing how alcohol just blocks all this stuff
we love doing? Isn't it? It's all there. Your kind nature, Ryan, wanting to reach back and help others, your gift for writing, the stuff that I've done since I stopped drinking. Ben, the same for you. We've got so many community members. We go, you've changed, I've changed. I truly believe it's all there. It's all there in us, except when you aren't drinking, it's like having a big fat dustbin lid on your life and it's just all squashed and grey and horrid. And then when you go, you know, I'm going to remove booze, it's like that scene. Somebody else described it, the scene in The Wizard of Oz where it goes from black and white to glorious Technicolor and it's like, ta-da! And everything you ever enjoyed as a child when you didn't even know what alcohol was, when you were so... pure and, you know, not stained by alcohol, it's all there. It just sort of needs releasing and coaxing out. I get dead excited over stuff like this, Ryan.
How much of your soul do you bear, Ryan? Like, how much do you give us in the book?
I really tried to be as honest and vulnerable as I possibly could. And it was a tough process because I wrote the first draft and I just really kind of wanted to be mindful of not over explaining and not making it into like a case study for my grad school class. And so I think the first draft really was kind of like just a chronicle. And I wanted just the story to kind of speak for itself and not really over explain. And then I got some good feedback. I took it to an editor who read it and gave me some notes and feedback. And really more than anything, what he said was, this is good. But you can go further, you know, you can be more descriptive. You can really be honest in a way that is like, just leaves the reader no choice but to connect to the feelings of the experience that you were going through, take the reader on the journey. And so I took that as a challenge, you know, and I realized he was spot on in that if I wanted to accomplish what the purpose of this book was, it had to be as genuine and vulnerable as I possibly could bear to make it. For two reasons, really. It served two functions. One, yes, because I wanted to connect to an audience, but also because it was like therapy for me. You know, writing this book was narrative therapy. It was rewriting my story in a way that was going to be more useful for me. And so I when I was writing the parts about the start of the band and the fun and the inspiration of that, I was having fun. It was joyful. And then when I got to the dark parts and the loss and the disappointment and the and the depression and the anxiety, I was feeling really uncomfortable and really in a dark place while I was writing it, because I had to go back to those depths and really, really process it in a way that I probably hadn't really completely until I wrote this book. So it became closure for me. Ultimately, writing this book was the closure that I needed on that chapter of my life. And then I got to the recovery aspects at the end of the book, the happy ending. And that was, again, inspiring and hopeful and joyful to write for me. So I knew that if I was having those feelings in writing it, that there was a good chance that people reading it might be able to connect to it in the same way. And so I felt I had to go there. I had to go as deep as I could allow myself to.
Ryan, one of our community members, Maggie, who's also in the States, I know it's a massive place. She's probably not near where you are right now, but my geography is diabolical. Maggie's just...
360 million people live there.
All
know,
right. Maggie says
around the corner.
That your story is very inspirational, Ryan. And she's brought up something that I wanted to mention myself. Curious to know what your relationship is with the band today, because Adam Levine wrote the foreword to your book, didn't he? So Maggie says, I assume you're still close. What is the situation like now?
Yeah, Adam and I are like brothers. You know, I wish that we saw each other more than we do. I would love to have the relationship that we had living in a submarine together on the road. You know, maybe not that close.
But a bit too close, right?
But I think it's the kind of thing where it's like all of the guys, it almost like we were in the army together, or, you know, we played on a team when we were kids. Like when we run into each other, it's like no time has passed at all. And then it seems like 100 years have passed at the same time. And they're my brothers. You know, I love them. I will love them to the day I die. They'll always have a very special place in my life, in my heart, because it was, I mean, that band and what we started in high school was really inspiring. I feel very grateful. You know, part of writing the book and having the closure that I do on that chapter is coming to a place where my relationship with them and with the music and with the band is at this point only positive. It's just gratitude for having done what we did together, for the experience that I got to have with them as people and as musicians. And I'm just so happy for them to see them having the success they're having. And Adam and I, you know, we text every now and then, just silly stuff to each other as if we're still teenagers, you know, just trying to make each other laugh. But now it's got the added element of the fact that we're older and, you know, he has a family and I have my own life going on in different, you know, new and exciting directions that we get to share those things with each other. So there's a more grown-up aspect along with the teenage silliness.
Have you had much of a conversation about, you know, where you got to with alcohol with them? Or is that, because obviously you must have read the book by writing the foreword.
Yeah. It's funny what happens when you hit sort of middle age and you have a little bit more perspective on your life and a little bit more emotional maturity, hopefully a little more emotional maturity. Some people don't, but I know that the guys in the band, you know, have grown up a lot as well as I have in the last 20 years. We were just kids, you know, back then. And we've all got our own stuff going on in our lives. And when we do talk, that, you know, there is more candor and there is more connection to the vulnerable sides of ourselves than there was when we were just, you know, those idiot kids. So yeah, Adam read the book. Actually, I think all of them read the book. James was really kind. He gave me some of his feedback. I really wanted their support, you know, and if they had any issues with anything, I wanted them to voice it to me. James had one or two little notes that he gave me that I addressed, and Adam was just very supportive. I asked him to do the foreword and he didn't hesitate at all. He's like, of course, I got you, man. And the foreword that he wrote is beautiful. It really was really, really sweet and kind and meant a lot to me that he did that and that he put his heart into it, because he clearly did put his heart into it.
Ryan, I absolutely cannot wait to read the book. And I just think, you know, great title. Love that Adam's done the foreword. Is there anything else that you want to say about what's your kind of you know, your one-liner to, if someone's still not sure if they're going to be going and getting harder to breathe or not, what would you say to them?
Well, you know, if you come for the story of the band and Maroon 5, you won't be disappointed. There's a lot of great fun stories in there. There's a lot about the relationship between us and you know, just what it was like to be kids going on this journey together. But that's the context for something bigger, which is the story of hope and recovery. And you don't have to have been in a band. You don't have to have had, you know, any real similarities to my life in particular, to relate to the feelings, you know, and the things that I struggled with are things that are very common. You know, being in Maroon 5 is not very common, but the things that I struggled with are very common. And so I think that my hope is that a lot of people, not necessarily even music fans, you know, people that just want to hear a story of hope, will relate to the things that I went through and hopefully relate and see themselves in the possibilities in recovery.
It's been an amazing story. It really has. If people want to find more about what you do with your therapy, Ryan, follow you on social media, what should they look for?
Well, my website is up now, ryandusick.com. That's the one spot for everything that I'm doing as an author and speaker and therapist and life coach. Instagram, Ryan Michael Dusick, Ryan_Michael_Dusick is a good place to check out some photos and videos and stuff. And that's about it.
It's been brilliant. Thank you so much. I know Ben has really enjoyed this. Ben, what was the song that did it for you back in the day?
Oh, I mean, This Love was the big one from the album, but the opening Harder to Breathe is it just, it's that guitar, it's that kind of da-na, straight away, and you go, right, I'm gonna like this album. It's just those two notes, da-na. And then my I love, honestly, the whole album, to the point where, you know, you kind of remember CDs when you start to see scratches on them, because you just use them so much. But no, Not Coming Home is one of my favorites, and you had a writing credit on that one as well, didn't you, Ryan?
Yeah, I take a lot of pride in that.
Great song.
I'm loving this. Absolutely loving it. Ben, thank you for sharing this. You know what my favourite is?
Gemma watching, by the way, did a dance routine to Harder to Breathe.
No way.
Love it.
This is
Gemma, one day you have to send us a video.
This is brilliant. This is so good. I was a little bit late to the Maroon 5 party. Mine was more 2010 because I renamed that song Moves Like Jagger, and every time I danced to it, it was like, moves like Shazza, I got those moves like Shazza.
Shaz, so you know catchy. What, Shaz? In that case, you've got to go back and listen to earlier Maroon 5.
I
don't, you know, it's great to hear that you've got a good relationship with the band. I don't want to slag your mate yourself, but it's like a different band. Like, it is like a different band. Honestly, anyway, you're going to get me off on one. This is a podcast about alcohol-free life, and it's been great to meet you. Ryan, honestly, it's been a real pleasure, and wish you huge success with the book. And thank you for being so open and honest and vulnerable with us here on Over the Influence.
Thank you guys so much. It's been a pleasure. I appreciate this.
What a thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyable chat on Over the Influence. We get these guests, don't we, Ben? Week in, week out. You know, 52 guests a year from all walks of life. We've got bigwigs in the AF world, the authors, ordinary people sharing extraordinary stories, and actual rock stars as well. I'm going to buy that book, by the way. I imagine you've already got it on order.
Yeah, too right. And I imagine it's going to be gnarly.
Gnarly. That's a great...
I thought, you know, 25% of our audience are American, gnarly, as we said in the middle. Do we need to start using more Americanisms in the podcast?
Is gnarly... I thought that was an Australian-ism.
Ah, I can tell you the stats for Australia as well, if you're interested.
Let's go global. Are
you interested?
I'm always interested.
Is anyone
in your
interested?
Stats, Ben. Ooh, sorry, Con, you were
Sydney's
saying?
Sydney's our fourth biggest city, followed by Melbourne, and then Brisbane, and then Perth. In fact, there's a lot of Australian cities in our top 10.
Gnarly. Gnarly. What? I don't even know how to use that word.
But, you know, while we're talking about international community members and people flying over, we mentioned Chris in the middle bit, flying in from New York to go and hike Ben Nevis with us next year. Don't forget, our first ever OCI event, Nicole, flew in from Brisbane. And we've got Aussie time zone Aussie/New Zealand time zone Zooms going on as well.
Say that again, because I really enjoyed you trying to string that together. Go on.
time zone Zooms.
Take another run up at that one.
We've got Aussie and New Zealand specific time zone Zooms.
That's the one. Nailed it.
It's a good job I'm not drinking. Imagine saying that after a few pints.
Is it?
But yeah, you know, just because we're based in the UK doesn't mean you can't join us. You know, we're there for everyone. It's an online community. It's one of the beauties of it. And we love it. I love being on a Zoom call, actually, because we get quite a lot of Aussies on my morning one, because the time difference means it's the evening
for
Australia. And it's so cool to be able to be on the Zoom and be like, and now we're going to pass over to Brisbane.
Yeah.
And now calling Glasgow. And then, you know, you kind of just, you hop all over. It is very cool.
It's brilliant. It's Tres International. And I was on my Zoom call last week. I do one UK time on a Friday, Friday tea time. If you're from the south and you're posh, I do it at dinner time on a Friday. 6 o'clock, it's tea time after your chippy tea. And last week, all the Scots were on. Loads of them.
Okay.
Absolutely loads of them. I need a translator because there's some really, really strong accents on that call. But what was brilliant, what was ace, is that the three Scottish members on that call were giving Chris advice on where to stay, where to travel to, where to visit when he comes over.
Scotland's highest mountain.
Ben Nevis, you see. And yeah, I just sit back and I'm like, well, isn't this nice? Watching the connections happen. Honestly, so good.
Another great guest next week.
It's always a great guest next week. It's always a great guest. Cannot wait. Really looking forward to it. Loved that chat with Ryan. Loved watching Ben. Fanboy throughout. Same time next week. And as we were talking there about the amazing community, singing its praises, of course we are. We feel really passionate about it and we absolutely adore it and the people that are in there. OverTheInfluence.co.uk. This was meant to be brief. Soz, it absolutely wasn't.